How's everybody this morning?
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
That's good. You don't look like a squirrel. All right, gentlemen, here we go. Thank you. Good to see everybody. Hope everybody had a good night's sleep. If you didn't, sorry about your luck. But J.D. Fine of Chattanooga, Tennessee, put all the clanging gong news issues in a bound volume. But as of now, there are only one of these. I mean, he put the quality, glossy paper. This is an amazing quality product that he put out. And if there are enough people interested, we're hoping to print several copies of this. It might be expensive, but I think this is almost like a keepsake. I think it's something you can really give your kids to introduce them to the truth. There are many short articles in here. There are funny illustrations, interesting illustrations on every page. And I think that if this was sitting on your coffee table at home, your kids or anybody would pick this up. And I'm thinking of offering this. You could have your son or daughter, your friend, anyone. I'm talking about your 50-year-old son, your 50-year-old daughter. Their names embossed in gold on here. I just think it would be a good introduction to some of these truths we know and love. Yes, I hesitate to call on Dan when he raises his hand.
I will be interested if you offer the Martin Zender bronze statue to go with it on the coffee table.
Yes, we do have a Martin Zender action figure. That if you order
a bobblehead,
okay.
That way we
can space you around. You do anyway. Only this time my head will move, right? Okay. I'll make it an opportunity. Remember, I had one more talk to finish up with the doom and gloom, which it actually isn't doom and gloom. It's the unveiling of Jesus Christ. But we're going to find a way to get that talk in today. I was going to offer you comfort concerning those of your loved ones who don't believe in the gospel. I just told you the terrible things that are going to be coming on the earth, and I want to conclude that talk sometime, and we're going to get opportunity to do that. But I'm going to change channels here this morning, and I'm going to talk about Christ. This was the other topic that Charles had on his heart, to talk about Christ, his relationship to God. And I knew Clyde and Dan would be talking about the relationship, and I want to talk about what Christ does this morning. I want to talk about how Christ solved, the title of my talk is Christ Solves Our Two Vital Problems. That's not a very snappy book title, and I don't think I'd ever use that for a title of a book, but we have two problems in that we are sinners and that we are enemies. As sinners, we have failed God's standards, and as enemies, we have hurt His feelings. These are our two problems. We've done wrong, and we've fallen from grace. This was an early view of things. God has repaired it through His Son, Jesus Christ. Every problem we've had, He has repaired it. And I want to show you how He exactly meets our problems. It's a great thing to see. We're going to compare what we do with what we are. We're going to compare acts with facts, and we're going to compare the consequences. Sin is what we do. We sin. Enemies is what we became under Adam. An enemy is what we are. A sin is what we do. Because we're sinners, we suffer. But because we became estranged from God, and this began with Adam in the garden, I'm going to show you that. Because we became estranged, we die. We suffer for what we do. We die because of what we are. We suffer because we're sinners. We die because we're enemies. One is an act. One is a fact. And this will help you understand death. And it'll help you understand, can everybody see this board? It'll help you understand how Christ answered death and how He answered sin. And I'm going to show you the two benefits now, amazing benefits that Paul explains in the book of Romans. The benefits of justification and conciliation. There's some really exquisite language in Romans chapter 5 that's going to show you how God meets our two vital problems. The first person who did this to us was Adam. Not surprisingly, he started the ball rolling. And I like how Clyde pointed out that Adam was, or maybe it was Dan, Adam is the prototype human. He was the first. And he really sets up the contrast for the last Adam. We don't understand what the last Adam did, what Christ did, unless we know the trouble we've gotten into from the first Adam. And again, the trouble is twofold. We're sinners and we're enemies. I'd like to go to Romans 5:19. I'm going to paint the picture of the problem here first for you. For even as through the disobedience of the one man, the many were constituted sinners. That's all I want to read. The disobedience of Adam, what he did, what Adam did, he disobeyed God. He broke a law, one law in the garden, don't eat of the tree. Because of this, the many were constituted sinners. Adam sinned, and so we are sinners. He did something. Adam did something, and because of that, we do something. We sin. In the same context, I'd like to direct you to Romans 5:15. But not as the offense, thus also the grace. For if by the offense of one the many died, you see, he offended God. He not only transgressed, he not only disobeyed, but he offended God, and the result of the offense was death. Because of the offense of one, the many died. And we know that when God uses two different words, he has two different things to say. Transgression and an offense. What is a transgression? I could write this on a board, but I'm running out of room. The Greek word translated transgression in the concordant version is parabasis, and it means besidestep. A transgression is a besidestep. When you transgress, you make a bad move. You make a bad move, sidestep, besidestep. You're on the path and you step beside the path. You've made a wrong move, a bad move, parabasis, transgression, what we do, a sin. Now, an offense has the same prefix, para, but an offense is paratoma. P-A-R-A-P-T-O-M-A. It's beside fall. Transgression is a beside step. You make the wrong move. A beside fall is you fall out of favor. You hurt God's feelings. We don't often think of that, do we? That Adam had friendship with God in the garden. And his shortcomings were twofold. Again, he broke a law. He transgressed what God said. But it also hurt God's heart. And because of that, the friendship that Adam had was broken. And he no longer walked in the garden with God every day. As we're going to see, Christ heals both of these breaches. He takes care of the sin, which makes us right. And he takes care of the offense, which ends up making us friends again with God. How is this? I told you Adam started it, and we see that in Romans 5:15 and Romans 5:19. I want to show you how this played out in the Garden of Eden. I'm going to turn to Genesis 3:17. And to the human, he says, Elohim, as you hearken to the voice of your wife and are eating from the tree of which alone I instruct you, saying not to eat from it. He's setting up the law. Don't eat from that tree. And this is the transgression. Cursed shall be the ground when you serve it for your sakes. In grief shall you eat of it all the days of your lives. Thorns, weeds shall sprout for you, and you shall eat the herbage of the field. In the sweat of your face shall you eat your bread. Because of what Adam did, he would suffer. we suffer because of what we do. You reap what you sow. Actions, actions, sinners. What you do, you suffer. And we see that with Adam. The act was he transgressed the law. He became a sinner. It was because of what he did. And the result was the ground was going to be cursed and he would have to bring up the food by the sweat of his brow. But something else happened simultaneously, as I said. Not only did he transgress, but he hurt God's feelings. He became an enemy. And in Genesis 2, 16, I'm going to go to Genesis 2, verse 16. The day you eat of it, to die you shall be dying. Because now he hurt God's feelings, to die, looking at the end result, to die you shall be dying. This is the Hebrew. It doesn't read this way in the King James or other poor translations. To die, you shall be dying. To die, is because of the enmity. Death itself isn't suffering. Dying is suffering. Death is not suffering. Adam began a process of mortality, and he started to suffer, and he started to be dying. Because of what you did, to die you shall be dying. We're still looking at a twofold process here for two problems. Sinners and enemies, suffering and death, right? We're sinners. Suffering and death. Give me the two main problems of life. Suffering and death, yes. Yes, that is absolutely right. We suffer because of what we do, but we die because of who we are. Suffering afflicts the soul. Suffering To die, you shall be dying. The dying afflicts the soul. It's how we feel. We feel bad. We go through troubles. But death affects the spirit. Death takes the spirit away. When God removes the spirit, we die. When he breathes his spirit, we live. That's irrespective of what we do, isn't it? That's what I want to show you. Death is irrespective of what we do. This will help us understand why death is not a result of what we do, but of what we have become. This solves a lot of problems. It did for me when I began to understand this. Why an infant is no less dead than a confirmed criminal? Doesn't that bother you? Oh, they died too young. Death seems, it's a horrible reality, but why does it, the baby and Adolf Hitler are both equally dead? And when you understand this, you see why. They're not dead because of what they did. They suffered during life based on what they did. Maybe the criminal received a penalty or a punishment, or we reap what we sow. But whether you reap or sow good or bad, it doesn't matter. We all die. The confirmed criminal dies as well as the baby. The point is, a whole life of benevolence does not overcome mortality. You could live as good a life as possible. I mean, the classic example, Mother Teresa, she's dead. Adolf Hitler is dead. That's because we have a common lot, and this is based on a fact, not an act. Our death is based on fact, not an act. And again, this came from Adam. Here's a really illustrative verse. Some would say illustrative. I don't know. Speaking of illustrious, welcome to Susan. You walked in just as I said illustrative, and it made me think of illustrious, so I thought I'd point you out. Good morning. How are you? Romans 5:12, death passed through into all humanity. Death passed through. Let me start that verse at the beginning, Romans 5:12. Even through one man, sin entered the world, and through sin, death, and thus death passed through into all mankind, on which all sinned. You got that? There's going to be a quiz at the end. That's a very complex verse. Let me explain that to you. Adam was the first guy who sinned first and then began to die. Because of his sin, you hear this? Even through one man, sin entered the world. And through sin, death. Adam sinned, and to die you shall be dying. On that day he sinned, whether it was a Thursday or a Friday, he began to die that day. And thus death passed through onto all mankind. We inherit death, not sin. We inherit death, and we sin because we're dying. You see, death is the petri dish. It's on which sin flourishes and grows, and it's death that passed through. Adam sinned, and then he died. He passed through death, and we sin because we're dying. So death, we're not, you know, you hear this theological doctrine of total depravity. Well, it's not. There's nothing wrong with us. We're human beings, and we're going to be human beings in the resurrection. Did you know that? We're still going to be human beings. There's nothing wrong with humanity. We're just running low on spirit. Mm-hmm. We're running low on spirit. We're mortal. As soon as you take away mortality, you won't need to say anymore that you won't sin. It'll be a given because we sin because we're mortal. That's why all Paul needs to say in 1 Corinthians 15 is the mortal shall be made to put on immortality. And you don't even need to say that you will no longer sin. It's impossible for a person with immortality to sin because, again, death is the petri dish where sin flourishes. You take, just like the law, sin flourishes. You take that away, you take the host away, and the sin can't feed on it anymore. So that's a great truth. Death is a great equalizer. There's no adjudication in death. And here's this. This is going to help you understand the great white throne. Death is not a punishment. Death is not a punishment. The great white throne, when people go to the second death from the great white throne, they're not being punished any more than the baby is being punished when the baby dies. It's our common lot in Adam. And so the problem with the second death, people says, oh, well, we have to adjust death. But you see, you can't adjust death. You can't adjust it to the baby and Adolf Hitler. Death is the great equalizer. So it's very interesting in Romans chapter 2, verse 8, we learn that God is going to repay fury, affliction, and distress on every human soul affecting evil. I believe this occurs at the great white throne. You folks know what happens at the great white throne? Right? The dead and all the dead, the great and the small, those who have not been vivified, rise and they stand before God. They're alive. They're raised from the dead and they stand before God. And it's then that God afflicts their soul. The dead are going to be going through at the great white throne what we're going through now. It's a timing thing. It's a timing thing. God afflicts us now, and brings us to the end of ourselves now, and we learn about him. Wow. Well, that's going to happen for a whole lot of people at the great white throne while they're alive, not in death. The folks who want to make the second death a reform school is because they don't see that everything is going to be made right at the great white throne while they're alive, and they think it's not fair to put people in the second death. That's not fair. Was the first death fair? Is it fair to the baby? Is it fair to Hitler? They're both dead. Fairness doesn't come into the question. We simply die because of a fact we're enemies. And it's the common lot of the sons and daughters of Adam. You can't adjust things in death, so death isn't a punishment. Death isn't even a discipline. Death isn't based on what we do. It's not based on what we do. That's why the second death isn't judicial. All the adjustment takes place for us while we're alive here and at the dais. And for the dead, the great and the small, it takes place at the great white throne. I don't know, folks, if the great white throne is 5 minutes or 500 years or 5 seconds. All I know is you can't adjudicate someone who's dead. That's an important point, and we see it here. So people at the great white throne suffer for what they do. But the second death is those who simply are not found in the scroll of life. It's not based on their deeds. It's based on the fact that they are enemies. Now we're going to turn the page, and we're going to get to the good news of how Christ answers this. The wording in Romans 5 is really exquisite. And I'm going to read from Romans 5, 8, 9. And we keep in mind the two problems we have. Romans 5, 8 through 9, to begin with. Christ is commending this love of his to us, seeing that while we are still sinners, that's one of our big problems, while we are still sinners, Christ died for our sakes. Much rather than being now justified in his blood, we will be saved from indignation through him. This is phase one. This is phase one of what Christ did. Ah, what Christ did. You know what? Christ is not his name. It's his office. He was set apart by God to do something for us. What is this answer to? The act of sin, what we did. We became sinners. Something we did got us very badly messed up. Christ also did something to get us out of this. This is his office. What did he do? He died. He went through this horrible, it was an act. And this verse says what? It talks about his blood, doesn't it? It talks about what verse was that? 5, 8, and 9. God's commending this love of his to us. Christ died for our sakes, being justified in his blood. We're justified in his blood. What does the blood speak of? It speaks of the soul. The soul is in the blood, Scripture tells us. And the suffering, the soul, he suffered on the cross. There was a reason he had to be pinned on the Roman stake for 6 hours, because it answered all of our deeds. It answered what we do. You see, and he did this for sinners. While we were still sinners, while we were still sinning, Christ did something for sinners. And the result is justification. Justification means that you are now made right with God. That's a fine thing, but it's a judicial decision. It's almost like a cold fact. Okay, now you're right with God. Christ, his office, did an act. He died, shedding his blood. The suffering, his blood speaks of the suffering. And remember, the penalty for Adam was suffering. He would have to, through the sweat of his brow, bring up food from the ground. So Christ answers suffering with suffering. We suffer for what we do. And the result is that he cancels out all of this, and now we're right with God. We're justified. But to God, that's not good enough. Because even though you're brought before the court, and you're in there sitting in the court, and the judge pronounces you not guilty, that's a great thing, but it's a judicial decision by a person in an office. It's almost cold. It's almost, you know what I'm saying? That doesn't mean you're friends with a judge. The judge says not guilty, but you don't go to lunch with the judge unless you know the judge, in which case you're in good shape. I always thought it'd be great to go into the courtroom and have the judge wink at you like, it's like, wow, yeah. But listen, that's actually our situation.
It is. Yeah.
That's our situation. Scripture says that who is the condemner? Who will condemn us? Christ, the justifier? The only one who can condemn you is the one who justified you. He's the only one who can condemn you. Satan can't condemn you because Christ is higher up in the pecking order than Satan. So this is like we have it made. We're walking into the courtroom and the judge is Christ, the only one, and he's our justifier, and he winks at us. It's like, bring it. You know, I'm sitting in the witness stand. It's like, woo, you're all feeling good. Satan's over here, but Christ is back there, you know. So we're in good shape, really good shape. So now look at what happens in Romans 5:10. We're in the same context, but the wording is completely different. For if, being enemies, and remember, this is the same action. This is all happening at the cross, but we're looking at two different aspects of it to meet our two different problems. For if, being enemies, we were conciliated to God through the death of his Son, much rather, being conciliated, we shall be saved in his life. Look at the exquisite wording. All of a sudden, we've gone from Christ, which is his office, to Son, the death of his Son. This is a relationship. Adam lost a relationship with God. He became estranged. He became an enemy. And because of this, he entered the death state. That's what Christ did for us. He entered the state of death. He suffered. He suffered. And all that suffering took away our sin. But it did not take away the enmity. It did not take away the fact that we were estranged from his heart. This is what does it. Christ now, in his life, we're justified by his life. I mean, we're conciliated through his life. We're justified in his blood. We're justified because he answered with suffering, our suffering. But now it says we're justified by his death. I mean, we're conciliated in his death. He entered the death state. He gave his very life. Here he gives his soul. He gives his soul. He suffers on the cross for 6 hours. But then he said, It is finished. And at that point, he gave his very life. And that is a deeper, deeper, deeper thing than to suffer. He gave his life, and because of that, he did it for enemies. If, being enemies, we were conciliated by his death, as opposed to when we were sinners, we were justified by his blood. Now, he goes a deeper thing. It's a heart thing. It's a restoration of the deep lack that Adam also started for us and that we inherited. And the result is conciliation. This is a restoration of friendship. And these are the two huge themes of Romans. In the beginning of Romans is justification. We are declared righteous and our sins are done away. But again, there's more. God wants more for us. Now, we can not only be right, but we can be at peace. We can not only be justified, we can get back to this sonship relationship. Yeah. And then when you see what it took to do this, when you see what it took to do it, it'll make you appreciate even more, I believe, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on our behalf. Thank you.